You are listening to Mind Over Matters here on KEXP 90.3 FM Seattle. It is 8:30, and we're joined by none other than John Parrish and Maria Tomchik once again, invading our studios.
One of these weeks you'll say her name first, I hope, so we can find out what she likes being called none other than.
Actually, there's been a couple of weeks that you were gone where she got announced.
That's true.
I have to say, I did a show similar to this yesterday at a station in San Francisco that was a media roundtable, and the way the show was billed, there were other guests also, is New York Times. There was a person from the New York Times there, and I was like, New York Times meets Eat the State at last. It was pretty hilarious.
Do you think that was the first time New York Times actually had even heard of Eat the State?
I think it's a pretty good bet, yeah. But she came away impressed. It was a good show. But we got a lot more in, get a lot more into an average half hour here than they got into an hour. So,
well, we try to. And speaking of which, we have a lot to cover today, so let's just jump right into it. Folklife Festival coming up. And things might not be so sweet there.
It's already started, actually. It's already going on, and there are a couple of organizing efforts underway, just so people know that Ben & Jerry's is no longer the contractor this year. This year it's Nestle, and of course there are many people who are still upset about Nestle. Not much can be done about that this year because the contracts were long ago signed, but at the same time it's helpful to remember that Ben & Jerry's is no longer the hippy-dippy ice cream maker that it used to be. It's now owned by Unilever, which is Europe's largest conglomerate of any kind and the number three food conglomerate in the world behind Nestle and Kraft. And they certainly have their own corporate things that they shouldn't be proud of. But you go to Ben & Jerry's website and they make almost no mention of Unilever, no links to Unilever's website, and the whole imagery is still of the 60s VW bus and the small independent Vermont ice cream maker, and they're really trading off of the image, which is, I think, kind of fraudulent. But, you know, some folks are worked up about that. And then what was the theme of Folklife this year also?
The theme of Folklife this year is the backwoods and the lifestyle of the people who lived in the backwoods. And you know, when you've got something like that,
Like the movie Deliverance?
No, more like a movie about, clear-cutting or something.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, whenever you've got something like that, you could say, well, it's okay if it focuses on the people that live there and so forth. But, you know, the people that spend the most time in the backwoods are often loggers. So I don't know whether I'd be going to Folklife to protest the theme of Folklife more or whether I'm eating Nestle ice cream.
Or whether Weyerhaeuser is one of the major underwriters this year. That could be a problem, too.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see, and I may actually go take a look. It'd be interesting to see, you know, how much of that creeps into the little exhibits that they have there. I'm sure that there might be some effort to keep it out, but we'll see.
Well, hopefully you can bring us back a report next week on that.
Yeah, I'll try.
Maybe you can get in for free telling them you're with the media and doing a story about the whole
about
event.
It's a free festival, Mike.
They'll look at me and go...
I'll bet she can.
They'll look at me and go, God, she's a moron.
All right. Also in the news, or maybe a little bit this week, some local Syrians losing or being deported.
Yeah, this case has gotten quite a bit of attention. A Syrian couple and their family that had made their home up in Snohomish County, Linwood, for the past several years, operating a local deli, and they got swept up along with a number of other people from that part of the world, or people who look like they might be from that part of the world, post 9/11. There's still a gentleman from Tunisia who, on the basis of a psychotic housemate who rang up the FBI and said he was a Middle Eastern terrorist and then recanted and the FBI wasn't interested in him, but he's still in jail and will probably be there for at least the next year while the denial of his asylum claim goes through the appeals courts. The Syrian family had also applied for asylum over time and been denied, and now they're being deported by the INS. And it really points up a couple of things that are not particularly being highlighted in local media coverage of this. One is the United States' abysmal rate of honoring asylum claims from very clearly repressive countries where people can be killed for being deeply religious, for being politically controversial, even for being well-educated or westernized. But if they're U.S. allies, or if we buy oil from them, or if we sell weapons to them, which happens even more often, we often don't honor the asylum claims, and then we deport them. And once somebody from one of these countries has asked for asylum, that marks them in the eye of the government, and they're often going home to face a death sentence, formally or informally. So the prospects for this family from Syria, given what we know about the Syrian government, are not very good. The prospects for the gentleman from Tunisia are not very good, and the same is true for any number of people who are rotting without any kind of charges, without having made any kind of, you know, criminal malfeasance in the detention facility down here on South Airport Way. It's a very, very frightening little version of a police state that is safely out of the eyes and away from the minds of most people in this country.
All right.
Our cheerful little Saturday morning wake-up show here.
Okay. I'm depressed.
It only gets better.
Yeah, exactly. By the end of the hour.
We're just going to rip right through them this morning. Yeah.
Right.
There's a lot happening this week.
Our two senators seem very supportive of trade at any cost. Maybe you could talk about that.
You want to handle that, or shall I?
Why don't you start, and I'll jump in.
Okay, yeah. Fast track passed the Senate this week, and no particular surprise here, although they were both publicly labeling themselves as being on the fence. They probably never were in private. Both Patty Murray and Maria Cantwell, the very pro-business wing of the Democratic Party, which is now in ascendancy within that party, as we know, voted yes for fast track. It now goes to a conference committee hearing between the House and the Senate. The House actually was a much narrower vote last fall to pass fast track. Fast track, for folks who came in very late on this very long running story, is the what is now called the Presidential Trade Authority. It allows for things like NAFTA, the Free Trade Area of the America, or any bilateral agreements to allow the president to basically commit the United States to those treaties without congressional review, implement them, and then Congress goes back and rubber stamps them later. Now, this was done despite overwhelming evidence over the past number of years since we've had NAFTA, 7.5 years now, mm-hmm. that the trade agreements are costing U.S. jobs, that they are disastrous, not just for the U.S. economy, but for the economies of the largely third world countries, but also Canada, that we've entered into them with, and that there are any number of constituencies whose oxes are gored by this sort of thing. It's bad for the environment. It's bad for worker safety. It's bad for any number of things. But we're not even going to review these treaties now. And one of the reasons, of course, is that they don't stand up very well to review. Another of the reasons is that the Bush administration is very anxious to keep to itself as much of the power of the executive branch as they can. They've been trying very hard to build that up in any number of ways. But this is something Clinton wanted also. And it's very, very frightening as we see the attitude of the pro sort of global structure, IMF, World Bank, WTO forces, as saying, oh, all this structure is inevitable, even as the WTO kind of falls apart. And one of the reasons that the effort to pass fast track has really been redoubled, aside from the fact that Bush wants it also, is that the WTO has been weakened as an institution in the last several years, and the U.S.
is
pursuing...
In some cases by U.S. actions.
Yes, and the U.S. has been very intentionally pursuing regional multilateral and bilateral trade agreements as a way to not just supplement the WTO, but also craft quote-unquote free trade more on its own terms, so that the U.S. can engage in steel tariffs, engage in farm supports, engage in all these non-free market policies, but we can still force smaller, weaker countries to open their markets to us.
Yeah, I think, excuse me, I think among U.S. elites, the bloom is off the WTO. There have been a couple of decisions against us recently, and the Bush administration...
And many more in the pipeline.
Yeah, and many more coming up. And the Bush administration is looking at things like how the WTO would put constraints on something like the farm subsidy bill that just passed. And they're saying, well, you know, maybe there's something to be said about going to these bilateral agreements where you just negotiate with one country that you can easily bully and get favorable terms with, and there's nobody to review it, nobody to say, hey, wait a minute. So I think that's part of this, too.
And, of course, the Bush administration is pretty hostile to international controlling
institutions.
Institutions, controlling authorities, treaties, any of that sort of thing. We're seeing that with ABM and arms control and disarmament also, which we can talk about with Bush's trip to Russia and Europe as well.
Mm-hmm. They seem pretty hostile to domestic influence as well.
Yes. But there were also, we should mention, a number of people that were arrested Thursday afternoon at Maria Cantwell's office here in downtown Seattle. Got almost no media coverage at all locally, but folks who were protesting her vote on Fast Track. So.
Yeah, and that's the mystery. Why would the Democrats support something like this? And I have to admit, it's a bit of a mystery to me, too.
It's called campaign finance.
Yeah, it's called filling the coffers before this year's elections.
All right, moving along, Eastmore.
Eastmore is independent this week, and it is independent as a result, first and foremost, of the really heroic struggle and resistance over the past 27 years by the East Timorese people, but also because of a few guys who literally sat around in an apartment room in suburban New York City, Westchester County, Charlie Shiner and John Miller and some other folks, some of whom I know, who in the early 90s started up a thing called the East Timor Action Network, which took hold in Seattle and in the Bay Area and a number of other places around the U.S. and eventually around the world, and in solidarity with other grassroots activists around the world, and took an invasion which had been resisted all along by the East Timor, but which had been pretty much ignored in much of the rest of the world, including the United States, which gave its blessing to the Indonesian invasion in 1975, which
and
wound
its,
up...
And its military aid.
Yes, and its military aid to the invasion in 75, which, along with the ongoing occupation, wound up killing an estimated third of the East Timorese population and depopulating the rest, literally depopulating the villages, creating an enormous number of refugees. Indonesia, in contravention of all sorts of international agreements, although, you know, Israel's doing the same thing now, took their occupied territory and started populating it with their own people so as to dilute the original composition of the country.
Which Indonesia has done to many, many, many islands in its archipelago.
Yes, that's very true as well. But Through it all, East Timor became independent. And interestingly enough, this was an event celebrated all over the world as a very, very hopeful sign for the resistance of a people, for the ability of a people to become free. Got very little media coverage in the U.S. The U.S. role in the original invasion got very little media coverage. The refugees who are still massed along the border inside Indonesia in the province of West Timor got very little attention, and the fact that that the U.S. has been pretty hostile to the new East Timorese government in terms of trying to negotiate oil and gas agreements with outside agencies, it's gotten very little attention, and the U.S. Congress's rush to resume military aid to the Indonesian military, which has been a very willing and happy client of ours, even though there have been a number of atrocities and
there are
and
noted
bad
human
things.
Rights abuses.
Yes, in other Indonesian provinces as well as in West and East Timor. We're going to start selling arms to them again, and the army there and the military and the justice courts have never brought in any of the people who perpetrated the genocide in East Timor to justice for what they've done. So there were a number of aspects of this that you would think would make for pretty compelling news coverage, but we really hadn't heard any of that this week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we don't have a program for bringing people there to justice, but we do have a program for bringing generals that participate in these things to the U.S. and setting them up with nice homes.
Well, we also have a program that trains the people before they become generals. It's called the School of the Americas, but we also have similar institutions that train people from despotic governments all over the world. It's one of the ways in which we're ensuring that the war on terrorism is going to be able to go on for the next 50 years.
Well, speaking of the war on terrorism, the Bush administration, Bush has president-elect is in Europe doing a...
I'm surprised you put those two words in the same sentence.
he's doing a big PR campaign in Europe trying to get him back onto our side.
Yeah, he has visited Germany, Russia, and he's on his way to France and Italy. the interesting thing about Bush being in Europe, there's a couple of interesting things. One, he went to Germany and addressed the Bundestag, which is the German parliament, and he was basically making a speech for to try to get support for the U.S. war against Iraq, for invading Iraq, and he also is trying to set up a new mission for NATO, which really has no mission right now, and the German...
Not a new mission, a mission, period.
A mission, period, yeah. And it's funny, because if you listen to talk radio like I do, you'll hear European analysts say, well, you know, there really is no mission for NATO, and Bush largely failed in his speech because nobody's going to agree to any of this stuff. And what was very funny is right before Bush addressed the Bundestag, he was actually lectured by the president of the German parliament, who just... raked him over the coals for things like backing out on the Kyoto Treaty and the International War Crimes Court and so forth. And
this seems to happen to him in almost every country he visits. It's amazing.
Oh, yeah. Well, and it's because Bush is a moron, you know, and it's the secret's out. The U.S. government can't hide it anymore. Bush is a moron. And you can see that in this trip, because while there's a major conflagration coming to a head in Pakistan and India over Kashmir, none of the major U.S. foreign policy people can go because they're in Europe. Condoleezza Rice is in Europe holding Bush's hand. Colin Powell's in Europe chaperoning Bush. They can't let the guy do his own thing because who knows what he would do? He's so stupid.
It's not easy running an empire, especially when you have a moron at the head. And there was a very interesting, on this same theme, report in the Saudi press a couple of weeks ago. If folks remember the Crown Prince Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, who has been in Washington for like 25 years. He's a very well-known institution around the city. Gives big parties, etc. And he had a meeting with President on his Crawford, Texas ranch last week, and it was supposed to go on for an hour or so. And it actually went on for 6 hours. And the press reports in this country were that, well, the two guys got along famously, and this is why they spent so much time hanging around. As it turns out, there was a report in a daily in Saudi Arabia, which was not really picked up in this country, with an interview with the Crown Prince, where he was saying that the reason that the two men were there for so long is that the Crown Prince was actually literally schooling the president about the realities of Middle Eastern politics, that he knew nothing about the Middle East, that he just didn't have a clue and was very slow picking it up.
We're dealing with a man who is profoundly stupid and not only
and
that
out of his element.
Yeah, and not only that, he doesn't care. He doesn't want to know, and he doesn't want to deal with any of this international stuff. And the world is getting the idea, and we can see that particularly in what's going on in India and Pakistan. In India, the Indian government has said, officials from the Indian government have said, and Indian press people have said, this has got to be a wake-up call for the U.S. Pay attention to this. Pay attention to us. We can't deal with these attacks on our own parliament, with our own civilians being massacred. You know, wake up, you guys. And if it takes a the threat of nuclear war, that's what we'll do.
And it's not just a threat. I mean, this is a story that really has not gotten, again, the attention that it deserves in this country, or the attention from the U.S. government that it deserves. There are literally two nuclear powers on the verge of going to war in South Asia. It could very easily be the first time in human history that nuclear weapons are used by both sides in a war against each other.
And they are already shooting at each other.
Yeah, we're
across the border.
Very close to it. And yet we still have the President of the United States on the verge. It's coming up June 13th of walking away from the ABM treaty and the arms control structure of the world, which has prevented the world quite successfully for the last 30 years from adopting weapons of mass destruction. We have Donald Rumsfeld coming on in the last week and saying, and this is a direct quote regarding the ABM treaty, well, we were going to do whatever we wanted regardless. You know, saying basically that the U.S. doesn't give a flip about any kind of limitations that it might have signed on to in the past, which is a green light for any other country to not give a flip either. Extraordinarily dangerous thinking, and I mean, thinking is a sort of a loose term when it comes to Bush. But, I mean, the guys under him are some of the most predatory and venal and, you know, capable of acts of mass atrocity that Washington has ever seen. And that's a very broad and sweeping statement.
And that's very scary.
It's a very frightening time in this country. It really is.
And with Bush in Russia, the media here played it up as, oh, look, you know, he ditched the ABM treaty, but look, they're signing a treaty to reduce nuclear weapons.
All this
treaty does is it puts a few of them in storage. And when Bush was asked, you know, well, if you put a few weapons in storage and you've got how many thousands left over that are still active, why don't you just get rid of all of them? Why don't you just decommission all of them? If we're such good friends with Russia, why isn't it time to just get rid of the whole arsenal? And Bush couldn't really answer that because, you know, he's dumb. And so he just kind of stammered a bit and said, well, you don't know what might happen in 10 years. You know, you don't know what a future president might say. And, I mean, just every time the man has to open his mouth without a prepared speech, you really get a sense that he has not got a clue. And it's people like Donald Rumsfeld, who I think is psychotic, who are actually running the country.
It's also interesting, the new book that's out by Greg Palast, who's going to be in town, the British investigative reporter, he'll be coming through in a couple, 3 weeks. And he's got a very interesting report in there talking about how the U.S. and the various international institutions that it controls, the IMF, World Bank, et cetera, really plundered Russia when it was a fire sale, essentially, of all of its state-owned resources in the mid-90s when predatory capitalism was moving in. So it's not just that we're good friends with Russia, we're basically running Russia at this point, and the mafioso capitalism that we see there is something that we put into place, and that U.S.-based corporations have by and large been the major profiteers from.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking about India and Pakistan, and I've surmised for quite a while that Pakistan and Saudi Arabia are two countries rich for falling to pieces.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, and before, I mean, I know we're leaping around here a bit, but we should also mention that there have been enormous protests in Europe.
Yes, there have been enormous ones.
Meeting Bush. And that it's not just protests on the street, but a number of high-ranking officials, as with the head of the parliament, who have also been very vocal in their criticisms of Bush.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this week internationally, there have been, and I kind of saw this and kind of put it all together, there are three governments, major governments, that can impact what happens here in the U.S., particularly in the terrorism thing, that are in danger of toppling. And one of those is Pakistan over the Kashmir thing. We don't really know here. We don't really follow the Pakistani media, so we can't see the broad disaffection with General Musharraf. The referendum was a joke, and everyone in Pakistan knows it. There are Pakistani opposition people who have often been jailed or threatened by the Pakistani government, who have met and are calling for the ouster of Musharraf. There are Islamic militants that Musharraf cannot put down, because if he moves against them, he's looking at an uprising. There are people within his own government who are supporting Islamic militants in Kashmir. There are people within the intelligence service who train, and this has been verified by Western intelligence sources as well as intelligence sources within the region, that there are elements in the Pakistani intelligence that train the Kashmiri militants and provide them logistics support when they move into India for their attacks. So clearly, the pressure's on Musharraf to do something about these attacks in India, but he can't, because if he does, he'll be overthrown in a second. You know, so Pakistan is our guy that our government supports. Pakistan is in danger of being overthrown. There's a couple of other governments as well in danger of being toppled. Kyrgyzstan, you didn't hear about this at all here. I saw a tiny little blurb in the PI. This past week, the government of Kyrgyzstan resigned. The prime minister and his whole cabinet. The president is still in place, but the prime minister and his whole cabinet are out. And it's basically been in the face of massive demonstrations around the country and the blocking of the main north-south highway in Kyrgyzstan. Basically, the people of Kyrgyzstan are fed up. Kyrgyzstan, for people who don't know, is one of those republics, former Soviet republics, that is very close to Afghanistan. It is on the Chinese border. and it contains an air base that was formerly Kyrgyzstan's air base, but has been taken over by the U.S. to be used for the Afghanistan conflict.
And also to site weapons to encircle China, which is, again, part of the point of pulling out of the ABM treaty. So the U.S. is up to its eyeballs in Kyrgyzstan, even though the government there, or maybe because the government there, again, has engaged in strong-arm tactics in recent elections, has jailed political dissidents, has been
suppressed the opposition press.
And really has spawned an enormous Islamic militant movement that has called for, you know, freedom and democracy and all those sorts of things that we try and put down in the region. And we're now calling those movements terrorism because, of course, there's a lot of trans-border stuff that's gone on with folks in Afghanistan.
And notably, the Kyrgyzstan protests have been nonviolent up to this point, and the government can't really respond with violence. It has once, and that's led to this government having to step down. So there's danger that the Kyrgyzstan government would collapse, hopefully to be replaced by something a little more democratic. The third government that I want to just look at really quickly, as this week Ariel Sharon was shoving through his economic plan in Israel through the parliament, and to get that done, he actually had to fire some of his cabinet ministers from the Shas party and the United Torah Judaism, two Orthodox parties that represent primarily poor and Sephardic people in Israel. They voted against the plan because it's going to impact poor people in Israel negatively. But Sharon fired them from his government, and what that has done is it's driven those two parties out of his coalition. He now has the barest minority of seats in parliament, 60 out of 120. And all it would take is a no-confidence vote to force early elections and to oust Sharon. So that's something we should be keeping an eye on. And we should remember, too, that as part of his coalition, he has the Labor Party, who does not support his actions in the occupied territories, does not support military intervention, and they do support a Palestinian state.
And you also have a lot of noise from Netanyahu, who's even on the far right in his own party. He's even more frothing and mm-hmm. you know, literally calling for, he calls it transfer, more objective people call it ethnic cleansing of Palestinians from the entire, essentially greater Israel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so I think it's interesting to see here that economics have weakened Sharon's government, but it may be the whole Palestine issue that puts him out of office. So we'll see.
All right. Well, only a couple minutes left, and
I told you we'd get through more in a half hour. Then,
oh yeah, hey, no argument here. A couple calendar items.
Yeah, you heard Trevor and George this morning talk about their trips to Palestine. George is from Palestine. There's going to be some more of that coming up this week. If you want to see Trevor, Jake Mundy, or John Reese at any of their upcoming. Public appearances. There's going to be one tomorrow from 2 to 4 p.m., an eyewitness report from Palestine at the Independent Media Center. There will be an ASL interpreter for people who need one. That's downtown at 1415 3rd Avenue. There will be also one on Friday, the 31st, from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Ethnic Cultural Center in the U District. That's 3931 Brooklyn Avenue Northeast. That'll have Jake Mundy and John Reese.
Yeah, that's at the corner of Brooklyn and 40th.
Yeah. So those are definitely worth checking out. John has some incredible pictures from the Jenin refugee camp and some incredible stories to tell.
All right. Any other events coming up between now and next Saturday that you know of?
Or that we can safely talk about on the radio?
Yeah.
I think those are probably the most important.
Yeah, those
point.
Are the ones you yeah. can check right. out. If you want to find more, you can find a copy of Eat the State. Eat the State is out in bookstores, coffee shops, bars, restaurants all over town.
Last page is a full calendar of events around town. And, you know, we should also plug the calendar that we get some of our information from, but it's much more exhaustive because it's on the web. Gene Buskin's Peace Calendar has been around for a number of years, and it is, for folks who aren't familiar with it, it is the compendium of political and, for that matter, cultural events going on around town from a progressive political slant. I mean, literally hundreds and hundreds of things that are listed at any given time. It's on a website. It's, I believe,
www.scn.org. You can click on the activism link and then click on the calendar link.
Very good. So with that, once again, we're out of time. Talking this week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchek, co-editors at Eat the State. And yeah, Maria, you already said where we can find it. Perhaps
you can find it on the web. Here's good. Another web address for you to write down. www.eatthestate.org. And then Job has the phone number, since I can't memorize it to save my life.
It took me about a year to actually memorize it on the air, and Mike can testify to this, that I would sit there and I would go, it's 909. Well, never mind. We didn't bring it this week, but no, I have it now. It is area code 206-903-9461.
Yeah, we used to get a lot of calls from people who had numbers near that you would announce.
You never told me about that.
This is Guido's Pizza.
Yeah.
You're like,
yeah.
And I've actually gathered them all outside.
And
the
and we don't have any beef here. So what's this Eat the Steak that you keep? Some sort of catering service or?
All right. So you're both in town and will be joining us next week.
Yes.
Far as I know, far as we know.
That's the plan then. See you then.